for collecting them because it's important for us not to presume that everybody cool in our culture like God and Santa Claus is white and how the Black Santa empowers the whole African-American community. I actually think I kind of agree with her, I said. Yeah, well, it's a fine idea, but it happens to be bullshit. I'm not trying to spread the Black Santa gospel. If they were, they'd make Black Santas. Instead, they're trying to buy the entire world's supply. There's this old guy in Pittsburgh with the second biggest collection, and they're always trying to buy it off him. Ben spoke from the doorway. He'd been there a while, apparently. Radar, your failure to bop that lovely honey bunny is the greatest humanitarian tragedy of our time. What's up, Ben? I said. Thanks for the ride last night, bro. Chapter 15. Even though we only had a week before finals, I spent Monday afternoon reading Song of Myself. I wanted to go to the last two pseudo-visions, but Ben needed his car. I was no longer looking for clues in the poem so much as I was looking for Margot herself. I'd made it about halfway through Song of Myself this time when I stumbled into another section that I found myself reading and rereading. I think I will do nothing for a long time but listen, Whitman writes. And then for two pages, he's just hearing. Hearing a steam whistle. Hearing people's voices. Hearing an opera. He sits on the grass and lets the sound pour through him. And this is what I was trying to do, too, I guess. To listen to all the little sounds of her. Because before any of it could make sense, it had to be heard. For so long, I hadn't really heard Margot. I'd seen her screaming and thought her laughing. That now, I figured it was my job. To try, even at this great remove, to hear the opera of her. If I couldn't hear Margot, I could at least listen to what she once heard. So I downloaded the album of Woody Guthrie covers. I sat at the computer, my eyes closed, elbows against the desk, and listened to a voice singing in a minor key. I tried to hear, inside a song I'd never heard before, the voice I had trouble remembering after 12 days. I was still listening, but now to another of her favorites, Bob Dylan, when my mom got home. "Dad's gonna be late," she said through the closed door. "I thought I might make turkey burgers." "Sounds good," I answered, and then closed my eyes again and listened to the music. I didn't sit up again until Dad called me for dinner an album and a half later. At dinner, Mom and Dad were talking about politics in the Middle East. Even though they completely agreed with each other, they still managed to yell about it, saying that so-and-so was a liar, and so-and-so was a liar and a thief, and that the lot of them should resign. I focused on the turkey burger, which was excellent, dripping with ketchup and smothered with grilled onions. "Okay, enough," my mom said after a while. "Quentin, how was your day?" "Fine," I said. "Getting ready for finals, I guess." "I can't believe this is your last week of classes," Dad said. "It really does just seem like yesterday."
"It does," Mom said. A voice in my head was like, "Warning, nostalgia alert, warning, warning, warning."
Great people, my parents, but prone to bouts of crippling sentimentality.
"We're just very proud of you," she said. "But God, we'll miss you next fall."
"Yeah, well, don't speak too soon. I could still fail English." My mom laughed and then said,
"Oh, guess who I saw at the YMCA yesterday? Betty Parson. She said Chuck was going to the University of Georgia next fall. I was pleased for him. He's always struggled."
"He's an asshole," I said. "Well," my dad said, "he was a bully, and his behavior was deplorable." This was typical of my parents. In their minds, no one was just an asshole. There was always something wrong with people other than just sucking. They had socialization disorders, or borderline personality syndrome, or whatever. My mom picked up the thread.
"But Chuck has learning difficulties. He has all kinds of problems, just like anyone. I know it's impossible for you to see peers this way, but when you're older, you start to see them, the bad kids and the good kids and all kids, as people. They're just people who deserve to be cared for. Varying degrees of sick, varying degrees of neurotic, varying degrees of self-actualized. But, you know, I always liked Betty, and I always had hopes for Chuck. So it's good that he's going to college, don't you think?"
"Honestly, Mom, I don't really care about him one way or another. But I did think, if everyone is such a person,
How come Mom and Dad still hated all the politicians in Israel and Palestine? They didn't talk about them like they were people. My dad finished chewing something and then put his fork down and looked at me. "The longer I do my job," he said, "the more I realize that humans lack good mirrors. It's so hard for anyone to show us how we look, and so hard for us to show anyone how we feel." "That is really lovely," my mom said. I liked that they liked each other. "But isn't it also that on some fundamental level, we find it difficult to understand that other people are human beings in the same way that we are? We idealize them as gods or dismiss them as animals." "True. Consciousness makes for poor windows, too. I don't think I'd ever thought about it quite that way." I was sitting back. I was listening. And I was hearing something about her and about windows and mirrors. Chuck Parson was a person, like me. Margot Ross Spiegelman was a person, too. And I had never quite thought of her that way. Not really. It was a failure of all my previous imaginings. All along, not only since she left, but for a decade before, I had been imagining her without listening, without knowing that she made as poor a window as I did. And so I could not imagine her as a person who could feel fear, who could feel isolated in a room full of people, who could be shy about her record collection because it was too personal to share. Someone who might read travel books to escape having to live in the town that so many people escaped to. Someone who, because no one thought she was a person, had no one to really talk to. And all at once, I knew how Margot Ross Spiegelman felt when she wasn't being Margot Ross Spiegelman. She felt empty. She felt the unscalable wall surrounding her. I thought of her, asleep on the carpet, with only that jagged sliver of sky above her. Maybe Margot felt comfortable there, because Margot the person lived like that all the time. In an abandoned room, with blocked-out windows, the only light pouring in through holes in the roof. Yes, the fundamental mistake I had always made, and that she had, in fairness, always led me to make, was this. Margot was not a miracle. She was not an adventure. She was not a fine and precious thing. She was a girl. Chapter 16. The clock was always punishing, but feeling like I was closer to unraveling the knots made time seem to stop entirely on Tuesday. We'd all decided to go to the mini-mall right after school, and the waiting was unbearable. When the bell finally rang for the end of English, I raced downstairs and was almost out the door when I realized we couldn't leave until Ben and Radar finished band practice. I sat down outside the band room and took a personal pizza wrapped in napkins from my backpack, where I'd had it since lunch. I was through the first quarter when Lacey Pemberton sat down next to me. I offered her a piece. She declined. We talked about Margot, of course, the hole we had in common. "What I need to figure out," I said, rubbing pizza grease onto my jeans, "is a place, but I don't even know if I'm close with the pseudo-visions. Sometimes I think we're just entirely off track." "Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, everything else aside, I like finding stuff out about her. I mean, that I didn't know before. I had no idea who she really was. I honestly never thought of her as anything but my crazy, beautiful friend who does all the crazy, beautiful things." "Right. But she didn't come up with these things on the fly," I said. "I mean, all her adventures had a certain, I don't know, elegance," Lacey said. "She's the only person I know who's not, like, grown up, who has total elegance." "Yeah. So it's hard to imagine her in some gross, unlit, dusty room." "Yeah," I said, "with rats." Lacey pulled her knees to her chest and assumed the fetal position. "Ick, that's so not Margot." Somehow, Lacey got shotgun, although she was the shortest of us. Ben was driving. I sighed quite loudly as Radar, seated next to me, pulled out his handheld and started working on Omnictionary.
"Just deleting vandalism on the Chuck Norris page," he said. "For instance, while I do think Chuck Norris specializes in the roundhouse kick, I don't think it's accurate to say Chuck Norris's tears can cure cancer. But unfortunately, he has never cried. Anyway, vandalism deletion only takes like 4% of my brain."
I understood Radar was trying to make me laugh, but I only wanted to talk about one thing. "I'm not convinced she's in a pseudo-vision. Maybe that's not even what she meant by paper towns, you know? There's so many place hints, but nothing specific." Radar looked up for a second, and then back down at the screen.
Personally, I think she's far away, doing some ridiculous roadside attraction tour that she wrongly thinks she left enough clues to explain. So I think she's currently in, like, Omaha, Nebraska, visiting the world's largest ball of stamps, or in Minnesota checking out the world's largest ball of twine.
With a glance into the rearview mirror, Ben said,
"So you think that Margot is on a national tour in search of various world's largest balls?"
Radar nodded.
"Well," Ben went on, "someone should just tell her to come on home, because she can find the world's largest balls right here in Orlando, Florida. They're located in a special display case known as My Scrotum."
Radar laughed, and Ben continued.
"I mean, seriously, my balls are so big that when you order French fries from McDonald's, you can choose one of four sizes. Small, medium, large, and my balls."
Lacey cut her eyes at Ben and said,
"Not appropriate." "Sorry," Ben mumbled. "I think she's in Orlando," he said, "watching us look, and watching her parents not look."
"I'm still for New York," Lacey said. "All still possible," I said. "A Margot for each of us, and each more mirror than window." The mini-mall looked as it had a couple days before. Ben parked, and I took them through the push-open door to the office. Once everyone was inside, I said softly,
"Don't turn on the flashlight yet. Give your eyes a chance to adjust."
I felt fingernails dig at my forearm. I whispered,
"It's okay, Lace."
"Whoops," she said.
"Wrong arm."
She'd been searching, I realized, for Ben. Slowly, the room came into a hazy gray focus. I could see the desks lined up, still waiting for workers. I turned on my flashlight, and then everyone else turned theirs on as well. Ben and Lacey stayed together, walking toward the troll hole to explore the other rooms. Radar walked with me to Margot's desk. He knelt down to look closely at the paper calendar frozen on June. I was leaning in next to him when I heard fast footsteps coming toward us.
"People,"
Ben whispered urgently. He ducked down behind Margot's desk, pulling Lacey with him.
"What? Where?"
"Next room,"
he said.
"Wearing masks. Official looking. Gotta go."
Radar shone his flashlight in the direction of the troll hole, but Ben knocked it down forcefully.
"We have to get out of here."
Lacey was looking up at me, big-eyed and probably a little pissed off that I'd falsely promised her safety.
"Okay,"
I whispered.
"Okay, everybody out through the door. Very cool, very quick."
I had just started to walk when I heard a booming voice shout,
"Who goes there?"
Shit. I said. "We're just visiting." What an outlandishly lame thing to say. Through the troll hole, a white light blinded me. It might have been God himself.
"What are your intentions?"
The voice had a slight faked Britishness to it. I watched Ben stand up next to me. It felt good not to be alone.
"We're here investigating a disappearance," he said, with great confidence. "We weren't going to break anything."
The light snapped off, and I blinked away the blindness until I saw three figures, each wearing jeans, a t-shirt, and a mask with two circular filters. One of them pulled the mask up to his forehead and looked at us. I recognized the goatee and flat, wide mouth.
"Gus?"
asked Lacey. She stood up, the SunTrust security guard.
"Lacey Pemberton? Jesus, what are you doing here, with no mask? This place has a ton of asbestos."
"What are you doing here?"
"Exploring," he said.
Somehow Ben was emboldened with enough confidence to walk up to the other guys and offer handshakes. They introduced themselves as Ace and the Carpenter. I would venture to guess that these were pseudonyms. We pulled around some rolling desk chairs and sat in an approximate circle.
"Did you guys break the particle board?"
Gus asked.
"Well, I did,"
Ben explained.
"We taped that up because we didn't want anyone else in. If people can see a way in from the road, you get a lot of people coming in who don't know shit about exploring. Bums and crack addicts and everything."
I stepped forward toward them and said, "So you, knew that Margot came here?" Before Gus answered, Ace spoke through the mask. His voice was slightly modulated, but easy to understand.
"Man, Margot was here all the damn time. We only come here a few times a year. It's got asbestos, and anyway, it's not even that good. But we probably saw her, like more than half the time we came here in the last couple of years. She was hot, huh?
Was?
Asked Lacey pointedly.
She ran away, right?
What do you know about that?
Lacey asked.
Nothing. Jesus,
I saw Margot with him, Gus said, nodding toward me, a couple weeks ago, and then I heard that she ran away. It occurred to me a few days later she might be here, so we visited.
I never got why she liked this place so much. There's not much here,
said the carpenter.
It's not great exploring.
What do you mean, exploring?
Lacey asked Gus.
Urban exploring. We enter abandoned buildings, explore them, photograph them. We take nothing, we leave nothing. We're just observers.
It's a hobby,
said Ace.
Gus used to let Margot tag along on exploring trips when we were still in school.
She had a great eye, even though she was only like 13, Gus said. She could figure a way into anywhere. It was just occasional back then, but now we go out like 3 times a week. There's places all over. There's an abandoned mental hospital over in Clearwater. It's amazing. You can see where they strapped down the crazies and gave them electroshock. And there's an old jail out west of here. But she wasn't really into it. She liked to break into the places, but then she just wanted to stay.
Yeah. God, that was annoying,
added Ace.
The carpenter said,
she wouldn't even, like, take pictures or run around and find stuff. She just wanted to go inside and, like, sit. Remember she had that black notebook, and she would just sit in the corner and write like she was in her house doing homework or something.
Honestly, Gus said, she never really got what it's all about. The adventure. She seemed pretty depressed, actually.
I wanted to let them keep talking because I figured everything they said would help me imagine Margot. But all of a sudden, Lacey stood up and kicked her chair behind her.
And you never thought to ask her about how she was pretty depressed, actually? Or why she hung out in these sketch-ass places? That never bothered you?
She was standing above him now, shouting, and he stood up too, half a foot taller than her, and then the carpenter said,
Jesus, somebody calm that bitch down.
Oh, no, you didn't,
Ben yelled, and before I even knew what was going on, Ben tackled the carpenter, who fell awkwardly out of his chair onto his shoulder. Ben straddled the guy and started pounding on him furiously and awkwardly, smacking and punching his mask, shouting,
she's not the bitch! You are!
I scrambled up and grabbed one of Ben's arms as Radar grabbed the other. We pulled him away, but he was still shouting,
I have a lot of anger right now! I was enjoying punching the guy! I want to go back to punching him!
Ben, I said, trying to sound calm, trying to sound like my mom. Ben, it's okay. You made your point. Gus and Ace picked up the carpenter, and Gus said,
Jesus Christ, we're getting out of here, okay? It's all yours.
Ace picked up their camera equipment, and they hustled out the back door. Lacey started to explain to me how she knew him, saying,
he was a senior when we were
But I waved it off. None of it mattered anyway. Radar knew what mattered. He returned immediately to the calendar, his eyes an inch away from the paper.
I don't think anything was written on the May page, he says. The paper is pretty thin and I can't see any marks, but it's impossible to say for sure.
He went off to search for more clues, and I saw Lacey's and Ben's flashlights dipping as they went through a troll hole, but I just stood there in the office, imagining her. I thought of her following these guys, 4 years older than her, into abandoned buildings. That was Margot as I'd seen her. But then, inside the buildings, she is not the Margot I'd always imagined. While everyone else walks off to explore and take pictures and bounce around the walls, Margot sits on the floor, writing something. From next door, Ben shouted,
Q! We got something!
I wiped sweat from my face with both sleeves and used Margot's desk to pull myself up. I walked across the room, ducked through the troll hole, and headed toward the 3 flashlights scanning the wall above the rolled-up carpet.
Look,
Ben said, using the beam to draw a square on the wall.
You know those little holes you mentioned?
Yeah.
They had to have been mementos tacked up there. Postcards or pictures, we think, from the spacing of the holes, which maybe she took with her,
Ben said.
Yeah, maybe,
I said. I wish we could find that notebook Gus was talking about.
Yeah, when he said that, I remembered that notebook,
Lacey said, the beam of my flashlight lighting up only her legs.
She had one with her all the time. I never saw her write in it, but I just figured it was like a day planner or whatever. God, I never asked about it. I get pissed at Gus, who wasn't even her friend, but what did I ever ask her?
She wouldn't have answered anyway, I said.
It was dishonest to act like Margo hadn't participated in her own obfuscation. We walked around for another hour, and just when I felt sure the trip had been a waste, my flashlight happened over the subdivision brochures that had been built into a house of cards when we first came here. One of the brochures was for Grove Point Acres. My breath caught as I spread out the other brochures. I jogged to my backpack by the door and came back with a pen and a notebook and wrote down the names of all the advertised subdivisions. I recognized one immediately, Collier Farms, one of the two pseudovisions on my list I hadn't yet visited. I finished copying the subdivision names and returned my notebook to my backpack. Call me selfish, but if I found her, I wanted it to be alone. Chapter 17. The moment Mom got home from work on Friday, I told her that I was going to a concert with Radar and then proceeded to drive out to rural Seminole County to see Collier Farms. All the other subdivisions from the brochures turned out to exist, most of them on the north side of town, which had been totally developed a long time ago. I only recognized the turnoff for Collier Farms because I'd become something of an expert in hard-to-see dirt access roads. But Collier Farms was like none of the other pseudovisions I'd seen, because it was wildly overgrown, as if it had been abandoned for 50 years. I didn't know if it was older than the other pseudovisions, or if the low-lying, swamp-wet land made everything grow faster, but the Collier Farms access road became impassable just after I turned in, because a thick grove of brambly brush had sprouted across the entire road. I got out and walked. The overgrown grass scraped at my shins, and my sneakers sunk into the mud with each step. I couldn't help but hope she had a tent pitched out here somewhere, on some little piece of land 2 feet higher than everything else, keeping the rain off. I walked slowly, because there was more to see than at any of the others, more places to hide, and because I knew this pseudo-vision had a direct connection to the mini-mall. The ground was so thick I had to walk slowly as I let myself take in each new landscape, checking each place big enough to fit a person. At the end of the street, I saw a blue and white cardboard box in the mud, and for a second, it looked like the same nutrition bars I'd found in the mini-mall. But no, a rotting container for a 12-pack of beer. I trudged back to the minivan and headed for a place called Logan Pines farther to the north. It took an hour to get there, and by now I was up near the Ocala National Forest, not really even the Orlando metro area anymore. I was a few miles away when Ben called. "What's up?"
"You hitting those paper towns?"
he asked. "Yeah, I'm almost to the last one I know of. Nothing yet."
"So listen, bro, Radar's parents had to leave town real suddenly."
"Is everything okay?" I asked. I knew Radar's grandparents were really old and lived in a nursing home down in Miami.
"Yeah, get this. You know the guy in Pittsburgh with the world's second largest collection of black Santas?"
"Yeah."
"He just bit it."
"You're kidding."
"Bro, I don't kid about the demise of black Santa collectors. This guy had an aneurysm, and so Radar's folks are flying to Pennsylvania to try to buy his entire collection. So we're having a few people over."
"Who's we?"
"You and me and Radar. We're the hosts."
"I don't know," I said. There was a pause, and then Ben used my full name.
"Quentin," he said. "I know you want to find her. I know she is the most important thing to you, and that's cool. But we graduate in like a week. I'm not asking you to abandon the search. I'm asking you to come to a party with your two best friends who you have known for half your life. I'm asking you to spend 2 to 3 hours drinking sugary wine coolers like the pretty little girl you are, and then another 2 to 3 hours vomiting the aforementioned wine coolers through your nose. And then you can go back to poking around abandoned housing projects."
It bothered me that Ben only wanted to talk about Margo when it involved an adventure that appealed to him, that he thought there was something wrong with me for focusing on her over my friends, even though she was missing and they weren't. But Ben was Ben, like Radar said. And I had nothing left to search after Logan Pines anyway. I've got to go to this last place, and then I'll be over. Because Logan Pines was the last pseudo-vision in Central Florida, or at least the last one I knew about, I had placed so much hope in it. But as I walked around its single dead-end street with a flashlight, I saw no tent, no campfire, no food wrappers, no sign of people, no Margo. At the end of the road, I found a single concrete foundation dug into the dirt, but there was nothing built atop it, just the hole cut into the earth like a dead mouth agape. tangles of briars and waist-high grass growing up all around. If she had wanted me to see these places, I could not understand why. And if Marco had gone to the pseudo-visions never to come back, she knew about a place I hadn't uncovered in all my research. It took an hour and a half to drive back to Jefferson Park. I parked the minivan at home, changed into a polo shirt and my only nice pair of jeans, and walked down Jefferson Way to Jefferson Court and then took a right onto Jefferson Road. A few cars were already lined up on both sides of Jefferson Place, Radar Street. It was only 8:45. I opened the door and was greeted by Radar, who had an armful of plaster black Santas.
"Gotta put away all the nice ones," he said.
"God forbid one of them breaks." "Need any help?" I asked. Radar nodded toward the living room, where the tables on either side of the couch held three sets of unnested Black Santa nesting dolls. As I re-nested them, I couldn't help but notice that they were really very beautiful, hand-painted and extraordinarily detailed. I didn't say this to Radar, though, for fear that he would beat me to death with the Black Santa lamp in the living room. I carried the Matryoshka dolls into the guest bedroom, where Radar was carefully stashing Santas into a dresser. "You know, when you see them all together, it really does make you question the way we imagine our myths." Radar rolled his eyes.
"Yeah, I always find myself questioning the way I imagine my myths when I'm eating my Lucky Charms every morning with a goddamn Black Santa spoon."
I felt a hand on my shoulder spinning me around. It was Ben, his feet fidgeting in fast motion like he needed to pee or something.
"We kissed! Like she kissed me! About 10 minutes ago! On Radar's parents' bed!"
"That's disgusting," Radar said. "Don't make out in my parents' bed."
"Wow, I figured you'd already gotten past that," I said. "What, with you being such a pimp and everything?"
"Shut up, bro! I'm freaked out!"
he said, looking at me, his eyes almost crossed.
"I don't think I'm very good."
"At what?"
"At kissing. And I mean, she's done a lot more kissing than me over the years. I don't want to suck so bad she dumps me. Girls dig you,"
he said to me, which was at best true only if you define the word girls as girls in the marching band.
"Bro, I'm asking for advice."
I was tempted to bring up all Ben's endless blather about the various ways in which he would rock various bodies, but I just said, "As far as I can tell, there are two basic rules. One, don't bite anything without permission, and two, the human tongue is like wasabi. It's very powerful and should be used sparingly." Ben's eyes suddenly grew bright with panic. I winced and said, "She's standing behind me, isn't she?"
"The human tongue is like wasabi,"
Lacey mimicked in a deep, goofy voice that I hoped didn't really resemble mine. I wheeled around. "I actually think Ben's tongue is like sunscreen," she said. "It's good for your health and should be applied liberally."
"I just threw up in my mouth," Radar said.
"Lacey, you just kind of took away my will to go on," I added.
"I wish I could stop imagining that,"
Radar said. I said, "The very idea is so offensive that it's actually illegal to say the words Ben Starling's tongue on television."
"The penalty for violating that law is either 10 years in prison or one Ben Starling tongue bath,"
Radar said. "Everyone," I said.
"Chooses,"
Radar said, smiling. "Prison," we finished together. And then Lacey kissed Ben in front of us.
"Oh, God,"
Radar said, waving his arms in front of his face.
"Oh, God, I'm blind. I'm blind."
"Please stop," I said. "You're upsetting the Black Santas." The party ended up in the formal living room on the second floor of Radar's house, all 20 of us. I leaned against a wall, my head inches from a Black Santa portrait painted on velvet. Radar had one of those sectional couches, and everyone was crowded onto it. There was beer in a cooler by the TV, but no one was drinking. Instead, they were telling stories about one another. I'd heard most of them before, band camp stories and Ben Starling stories and first kiss stories, but Lacey hadn't heard any of them, and anyway, they were still entertaining. I stayed mostly out of it until Ben said,
"Q, how are we going to graduate?"
I smirked. "Naked but for our robes," I said.
"Yes!"
Ben sipped a Dr. Pepper.
"I'm not even bringing clothes, so I don't wuss out," Radar said.
"Me neither! Q, swear not to bring clothes!"
I smiled. "Duly sworn," I said.
"I'm in,"
said our friend Frank, And then more and more of the guys got behind the idea. The girls, for some reason, were resistant. Radar said to Angela,
"Your refusal to do this makes me question the whole foundation of our love."
"You don't get it," Lacey said. "It's not that we're afraid. It's just that we already have our dresses picked out." Angela pointed at Lacey.
"Exactly,"
Angela added.
"Y'all better hope it's not windy."
"I hope it is windy," Ben said. "The world's largest balls benefit from fresh air."
Lacey put a hand to her face, ashamed.
"You're a challenging boyfriend," she said. "Rewarding, but challenging."
We laughed. This was what I liked most about my friends, just sitting around and telling stories, window stories and mirror stories. I only listened. The stories on my mind weren't that funny. I couldn't help but think about school and everything else ending. I liked standing just outside the couches and watching them. It was the kind of sad I didn't mind, and so I just listened, letting all the happiness and the sadness of this ending swirl around in me, each sharpening the other. For the longest time, it felt kind of like my chest was cracking open, but not precisely in an unpleasant way. I left just before midnight. Some people were staying later, but it was my curfew, and plus I didn't feel like staying. Mom was half asleep on the couch, but she perked up when she saw me.
"Did you have fun?"
"Yeah," I said. "It was pretty chill."
"Just like you," she said, smiling.
This sentiment struck me as hilarious, but I didn't say anything. She stood up and pulled me into her, kissing me on the cheek.
"I really like being your mom," she said.
"Thanks," I said. I went to bed with the Whitman, flipping to the part I'd liked before, where he spends all the time hearing the opera and the people. After all that hearing, he writes, "I am exposed, cut by bitter and poisoned hail." That was perfect, I thought. You listen to people so that you can imagine them, and you hear all the terrible and wonderful things people do to themselves and to one another, but in the end, the listening exposes you even more than it exposes the people you're trying to listen to. Walking through pseudo-visions and trying to listen to her does not crack the Margot Roth-Spiegelman case so much as it cracks me. Pages later, hearing and exposed, Whitman starts to write about all the travel he can do by imagining and lists all the places he can visit while loafing on the grass. "My palms cover continents," he writes. I kept thinking about maps, like the way sometimes when I was a kid, I would look at atlases and just the looking was kind of like being somewhere else. This is what I had to do. I had to hear and imagine my way into her map. But hadn't I been trying to do that? I looked up at the maps above my computer. I had tried to plot her possible travels, but just as the grass stood for too much, so Margot stood for too much. It seemed impossible to pin her down with maps. She was too small and the space covered by the maps too big. They were more than a waste of time. They were the physical representation of the total fruitlessness of all of it. My absolute inability to develop the kinds of palms that cover continents, to have the kind of mind that correctly imagines. I got up and walked over to the maps and tore them off the wall, the pins and tacks flying out with the paper and falling to the ground. I balled up the maps and threw them in the garbage can. On my way back to bed, I stepped on a tack like an idiot, and even though I was annoyed and exhausted and out of pseudo-visions and ideas, I had to pick up all the thumbtacks scattered around the carpet so I didn't step on them later. I just wanted to punch the wall, but I had to pick up those stupid goddamn thumbtacks. When I finished, I got back into bed and socked my pillow, my teeth clenched. I started trying to read the Whitman again, but between it and thinking of Margot, I felt exposed enough for this night. So finally, I put the book down. I couldn't be bothered to get up and turn off the light. I just stared at the wall, my blinks growing longer. And every time I opened my eyes, I saw where each map had been, the four holes marking the rectangle, and the pinholes seemingly randomly distributed inside the rectangle. I'd seen a similar pattern before, in the empty room above the rolled-up carpet. A map with plotted points. Chapter 18. I woke up with the sunlight just before 7 on Saturday morning. Amazingly, Radar was online. "Cue the resurrection. I thought you'd be sleeping for sure." "I'm Nictionary in 96.
"Nah, man, I've been up since 6, expanding the article on this Malaysian pop singer. Angela's still in bed, though."
Cue the resurrection.
Ooh, she stayed over?
I'm Nictionarian 96.
Yeah, but my purity is still intact. Graduation night, though. I think maybe.
Cue the resurrection.
Hey, I thought of something last night. The little holes in that wall in the strip mall. Maybe a map that plotted points with thumbtacks?
I'm Nictionarian 96.
Like a root.
Cue the resurrection.
Exactly.
I'm Nictionarian 96.
Want to go over? I have to wait till Ange gets up, though.
Cue the resurrection. Sounds good.
He called at 10. I picked him up in the minivan, and then we drove to Ben's house, figuring that a surprise attack would be the only way to wake him up. But even singing, "You Are My Sunshine," outside his window only resulted in him opening the window and spitting at us.
I'm not doing anything until noon,
he said authoritatively. So it was just Radar and me on the drive out. He talked a little about Angela and how much he liked her and how weird it was to fall in love just a few months before they would leave for different colleges, but I found it hard to listen very well. I wanted that map. I wanted to see the places she'd pinpointed. I wanted to get those tacks back into the wall. We walked in through the office, hustled through the library, paused briefly to examine the holes in the bedroom wall, and entered the souvenir shop. The place didn't scare me at all anymore. Once we'd been in each room and established we were alone, I felt as safe as I did at home. Beneath the display counter, I found the box of maps and brochures I'd rifled through on prom night. I lifted it out and balanced it on the corners of a broken glass counter. Radar sorted through them initially, looking for anything with a map, and then I unfolded them, scanning for pinholes. We were getting near the bottom of the box when Radar pulled out a black and white brochure entitled 5,000 American Cities. It was copyrighted 1972 by the Esso Company. As I carefully unfolded the map, trying to smooth the creases, I saw a pinhole in a corner.
"This is it," I said, my voice rising.
There was a small rip around the pinhole, like it had been torn off the wall. It was a yellowing, brittle, classroom-sized map of the United States, printed thick with potential destinations. The rips in the map told me that she had not intended this as a clue. Marco was too precise and assured with her clues to muddy the waters. Somehow or another, we'd stumbled into something she hadn't planned, and in seeing what she hadn't planned, I thought again of how much she had planned. And maybe, I thought, that's what she did in the quiet dark here, traveling while loafing, like Whitman had, as she prepared for the real thing. I ran all the way back to the office and found a bunch of thumbtacks and a desk adjacent to Margot's, before Radar and I carefully carried the unfurled map back to Margot's room. I held it up against the wall while Radar tried to get the tacks into the corners, but three of the four corners had ripped, as had three of the five locations, presumably when the map was taken off the wall.
"Higher and to the left," he said.
"No, down. Yeah. Don't move." Finally, we got the map on the wall, and then we started lining up the holes in the map with the ones on the wall. We got all five pins in pretty easily, but some of these pinholes were also ripped, so it was impossible to tell their exact location. And exact location mattered in a map blackened with the names of 5,000 places. The lettering was so small and exact that I had to stand up on the carpet and put my bare eyeballs inches away from the map even to guess each location. As I suggested town names, Radar pulled out his handheld and looked them up on Omnictionary. There were two unripped dots. One looked like Los Angeles, although there were a bunch of towns clustered so close together in Southern California that the type overlapped. The other unripped hole was over Chicago. There was a ripped one in New York that, judging from the location of the hole in the wall, was one of the five boroughs of New York City.
"That makes sense with what we know."
"Yeah," I said. "But God, where in New York? That's the question."
"We're missing something," he says. "Some locational hint. What are the other dots?"
"There's another in New York State, but not near the city. I mean, look, all the towns are tiny. It might be Poughkeepsie or Woodstock or the Catskill Park."
"Woodstock," Radar said. "That'd be interesting. She's not much of a hippie, but she has that whole free spirit vibe."
"I don't know," I said. "The last one is either Washington, D.C., or maybe Annapolis or Chesapeake Bay. That one could be a bunch of things, actually."
"It'd be helpful if there was only one point on the map," Radar said sullenly.
"But she's probably going from place to place," I said, tramping her perpetual journey. I sat on the carpet for a while as Radar read to me more about New York, about the Catskill Mountains, about the nation's capital, about the concert at Woodstock in 1969. Nothing seemed to help. I felt as if we'd played out the string and found nothing. After I dropped Radar off that afternoon, I sat around the house reading Song of Myself and half-heartedly studying for finals. I had calc and Latin on Monday, probably my two toughest subjects, and I couldn't afford to ignore them completely. I studied most of Saturday night and throughout the day Sunday, but then a Margot idea popped into my head just after dinner. So I took a break from practicing Ovid translations and logged onto IM. I saw Lacey online. I'd only just gotten her screen name from Ben, but I figured I knew her well enough to IM her. Q the Resurrection. Hey, it's Q. Sackcloth and Ashes. Hi. Q the Resurrection. Did you ever think about how much time Margot must have spent planning everything? Sackcloth and Ashes. Yeah, like leaving the letters in the alphabet soup before Mississippi and leading you to the mini-mall, you mean? Q the Resurrection. Yeah, these aren't things you think up in 10 minutes. Sackcloth and Ashes. Maybe the notebook. Q the Resurrection. Exactly. Sackcloth and Ashes. Yeah, I was thinking about it today because I remembered one time when we were shopping, she kept sticking the notebook into purses she liked to make sure it fit. Q the Resurrection. I wish I had that notebook. Sackcloth and Ashes. Yeah, probably with her, though. Q the Resurrection. Yeah, it wasn't in her locker? Sackcloth and Ashes. No, just textbooks, stacked neat like they always were. I studied at my desk and waited for other people to come online. Ben did after a while, and I invited him into a chat room with me and Lacey. They did most of the talking. I was still sort of translating, until Radar logged in and joined the room. Then I put down my pencil for the night. Omnictionary in 96. Someone from New York City searched Omnictionary for Margot Roth Spiegelman today. It was a kidney infection. Can you tell where in New York City? Omnictionary in 96. Unfortunately, no. Sackcloth and Ashes. Also, there are still some posters up in record stores there. It was probably just someone trying to find out about her. Omnictionary in 96. Oh, right. I forgot about that. Suck. Q the Resurrection. Hey, I'm in and out because I'm using that site Radar showed me to map routes between the places she pinholed. It was a kidney infection. Link? Q the Resurrection. TheLongWayRound.com. Omnictionary in 96. I have a new theory. She's going to show up for graduation sitting in the audience. It was a kidney infection. I have an old theory that she is somewhere in Orlando screwing with us and making sure that she's the center of our universe. Sackcloth and Ashes. Ben? It was a kidney infection. Sorry, but I'm totally right. They went on like that, talking about their Margos, as I tried to map her route. If she hadn't intended the map as a clue, and the ripped tackles told me she hadn't, I figured we'd gotten all the clues she'd intended for us, and now much more. Surely I had what I needed then, but I still felt very far away from her. Chapter 19. After 3 long hours alone with 800 words from Ovid on Monday morning, I walked through the halls feeling as if my brain might drip out of my ears, but I'd done okay. We had an hour and a half for lunch, to give our minds time to firm back up before the second exam period of the day. Radar was waiting for me at my locker. I just bombed me some Spanish, Radar said. I'm sure you did okay. He was going to Dartmouth on a huge scholarship. He was plenty smart. Dude, I don't know. I kept falling asleep during the oral part. But listen, I was up half the night building this program. It's so awesome. What it does is it allows you to enter a category. It can be a geographical area or like a family in the animal kingdom. And then you can read the first sentences of up to 100 Omnictionary articles about your topic on a single page. So, like, say you are trying to find a particular kind of rabbit but can't remember its name. You can read an introduction to all 21 species of rabbits on the same page in, like, 3 minutes. You did this the night before finals, I asked. Yeah, I know, right? Anyway, I'll email it to you. It's nerdtastic. Ben showed up then. I swear to God,
Q, Lacey and I were up on IM until 2 o'clock in the morning, playing on that site, the long way around. And having now plotted every single possible trip that Margot could have taken between Orlando and those 5 points, I realized I was wrong all this time. She's not in Orlando. Radar's right. She's coming back here for graduation day. Why? The timing is perfect. To drive from Orlando to New York, to the mountains, to Chicago, to Los Angeles, back to Orlando is like exactly a 23-day trip. Plus, it's a totally retarded joke, but it's a Margot joke. You make everyone think you offed yourself. Surround yourself with an air of mystery so that everyone pays attention. And then, right as all the attention starts to go away, you show up at graduation. No, I said, no way. I knew Margot better than that by now. She did want attention, I believed that, but Margot didn't play life for laughs. She didn't get off on mere trickery. I'm telling you, bro, look for her at graduation. She's going to be there. I just shook my head. Since everyone had the same lunch period, the cafeteria was beyond packed, so we exercised our rights as seniors and drove to Wendy's. I tried to stay focused on my coming calc exam, but I was starting to feel like maybe there was more string to the story. If Ben was right about the 23-day trip, that was very interesting indeed. Maybe that's what she'd been planning in her black notebook, a long and lonesome road trip. It didn't explain everything, but it did fit with Margot as a planner. Not that this brought me closer to her. As hard as it is to pinpoint a dot inside a ripped segment of a map, it only becomes harder when the dot is moving. After a long day of finals, returning to the comfortable impenetrability of Song of Myself was almost a relief. I had reached a weird part of the poem. After all this time listening and hearing people, and then traveling alongside them, Whitman stops hearing, and he stops visiting, and he starts to become other people. Like, actually inhabit them. He tells the story of a ship's captain who saved everyone on his boat except himself. The poet can tell the story, he argues, because he has become the captain. As he writes, I am the man. I suffered. I was there. A few lines later, it becomes even more clear that Whitman no longer needs to listen to become another. I do not ask the wounded person how he feels. I myself become the wounded person. I put the book down and lay on my side, staring out the window that had always been between us. It is not enough just to see her or hear her. To find Margot Roth-Spiegelman, you must become Margot Roth-Spiegelman. And I had done many of the things she might have done. I had engineered a most unlikely prom coupling. I had quieted the hounds of caste warfare. I had come to feel comfortable inside the rat-infested haunted house where she did her best thinking. I had seen. I had listened, but I could not yet become the wounded person. I limped through my physics and government finals the next day, and then stayed up till 2 a.m. on Tuesday finishing my final reaction paper for English about Moby Dick. Ahab was a hero, I decided. I had no particular reason for having decided this, particularly given that I hadn't read the book, but I decided it and reacted thusly. The abbreviated exam week meant that Wednesday was the last day of school for us, and all day long it was hard not to walk around thinking about the lastness of it all, the last time I stand in a circle outside the band room in the shade of this oak tree that has protected generations of band geeks, the last time I eat pizza in the cafeteria with Ben, the last time I sit in this school scrawling an essay with a cramped hand into a blue book, the last time I glance up at the clock. The last time I see Chuck Parson prowling the halls, his smile half a sneer. God, I was becoming nostalgic for Chuck Parson. Something sick was happening inside of me. It must have been like this for Margot, too. With all the planning she'd done, she must have known she was leaving, and even she couldn't have been totally immune to the feeling. She'd had good days here, and on the last day, the bad days become so difficult to recall because one way or another, she had made a life here, just as I had. The town was paper, but the memories were not. All the things I'd done here, all the love and pity and compassion and violence and spite, kept welling up inside me. These whitewashed cinder block walls, my white walls, Margot's white walls, we'd been captive in them for so long, stuck in their belly like Jonah. Throughout the day, I found myself thinking that maybe this feeling was why she'd planned everything so intricately and precisely.
Even if you want to leave, it is so hard. It took preparation, and maybe sitting in that mini-mall scrawling her plans was both intellectual and emotional practice. Margot's way of imagining herself into her fate. Ben and Radar both had a marathon band practice to make sure they would rock Pomp and Circumstance at graduation. Lacey offered me a ride, but I decided to clean out my locker because I didn't really want to come back here and again have to feel like my lungs were drowning in this perverse nostalgia. My locker was an unadulterated crap hole, half trash can, half book storage. Her locker had been neatly stacked with textbooks when Lacey opened it, I remembered, as if she intended to come to school the next day. I pulled a garbage can over to the bank of lockers and opened mine up. I began by pulling off a picture of Radar and Ben and me goofing off. I put it inside my backpack and then started the disgusting process of picking through a year's worth of accumulated filth. Gum wrapped in scraps of notebook paper, pens out of ink, greasy napkins, and scraping it all into the garbage. All along, I kept thinking, I will never do this again. I will never be here again. This will never be my locker again. Radar and I will never write notes in calculus again. I will never see Margot across the hall again. This was the first time in my life that so many things would never happen again. And finally, it was too much. I could not talk myself down from the feeling, and the feeling became unbearable. I reached in deep to the recesses of my locker. I pushed everything, photographs and notes and books, into the trash can. I left the locker open and walked away. As I walked past the band room, I could hear through the walls the muffled sounds of Pomp and Circumstance. I kept walking. It was hot outside, but not as hot as usual. It was bearable. There are sidewalks most of the way home, I thought. So I kept walking. And as paralyzing and upsetting as all the never-agains were, the final leaving felt perfect, pure, the most distilled possible form of liberation. Everything that mattered except one lousy picture was in the trash, but it felt so great. I started jogging, wanting to put even more distance between myself and school. It is so hard to leave until you leave, and then it is the easiest goddamn thing in the world. As I ran, I felt myself for the first time becoming Margot. I knew she is not in Orlando. She is not in Florida. Leaving feels too good once you leave. If I'd been in a car and not on foot, I might have kept going too. She was gone and not coming back for graduation or anything else. I felt sure of that now. I leave, and the leaving is so exhilarating, I know I can never go back. But then what? Do I just keep leaving places and leaving them and leaving them, tramping a perpetual journey? Ben and Radar drove past me a quarter mile from Jefferson Park, and Ben brought Rawpaw to a screeching halt right on Lakemont in spite of traffic everywhere, and I ran up to the car and got in. They wanted to play Resurrection at my house, but I had to tell them no, because I was closer than I'd ever been before. Chapter 20. All night Wednesday, and all day Thursday, I tried to use my new understanding of her to figure out some meaning to the clues I had, some relationship between the map and the travel books, or else some link between the Whitman and the map that would allow me to understand her travelogue. But increasingly, I felt like maybe she had become too enthralled with the pleasure of leaving to construct a proper breadcrumb trail. And if that were the case, the map she had never intended for us to see might be our best chance to find her. But no site on the map was adequately specific. Even the Catskill Park dot, which interested me because it was the only location not in or near a big city, was far too big and populous to find a single person. Song of Myself made references to places in New York City, but there were too many locations to track them all down. How do you pinpoint a spot on the map when the spot seems to be moving from metropolis to metropolis? I was already up and paging through travel guides when my parents came into my room on Friday morning. They rarely both entered the room at the same time, and I felt a ripple of nausea. Maybe they had bad news about Margot before I remembered it was my graduation day. Ready, bud? Yeah, I mean, it's not that big of a deal, but it'll be fun. You only graduate from high school once, Mom said. Yeah, I said. They sat down on the bed across from me. I noticed them share a glance and giggle. What? I asked.
Well, we want to give you your graduation present, Mom said. We're really proud of you, Quentin. You're the greatest accomplishment of our lives, and this is just such a great day for you, and you're just such a great young man.
I smiled and looked down, and then my dad produced a very small gift wrapped in blue wrapping paper.
No,
I said, snatching it from him.
Go ahead and open it.
No way,
I said, staring at it. It was the size of a key. It was the weight of a key. When I shook the box, it rattled like a key.
Just open it, sweetie,
my mom urged. I tore off the wrapping paper.
A key! I examined it closely. A Ford key. Neither of our cars was a Ford. You got me a car?
We did, my dad said. Now, it's not brand new, but only 2 years old and just 20,000 miles on it.
I jumped up and hugged both of them.
It's mine? Yeah!
My mom almost shouted.
I had a car of my own.
I disentangled myself from my parents and shouted, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, as I raced through the living room and yanked open the front door wearing only an old t-shirt and boxer shorts. There, parked in the driveway with a huge blue bow on it, was a Ford minivan. They'd given me a minivan. They could have picked any car, and they picked a minivan.
A minivan?
Oh, God of vehicular justice, why dost thou mock me?
Minivan, you albatross around my neck, you mark of Cain, you wretched beast of high ceilings and few horsepower.
I put on a brave face when I turned around.
Thank you, thank you, thank you,
I said, although surely I didn't sound quite as effusive now that I was completely faking it.
Well, we just knew how much you loved driving mine,
Mom said. She and Dad were beaming, clearly convinced they had landed me the transportation of my dreams.
It's great for getting around with your friends, added my dad.
And to think, these people specialize in the analysis and understanding of the human psyche.
Listen, Dad said, we should get going pretty soon if we want to get good seats.
I hadn't showered or dressed or anything. Well, not that I would technically be dressing, but still. I don't have to be there until 12:30, I said. I need to, get ready. Dad frowned.
Well, I really wanted to have a good sight line so I can take some pictures.
I interrupted him.
I can just take my car, I said. I can drive myself in my car.
I smiled broadly.
I know,
my mom said excitedly. Then what the hell? A car's a car, after all. Driving my own minivan was surely a step up from driving someone else's. I went back to my computer then and informed Radar and Lacey, Ben wasn't online, about the minivan. I'm Nictionarian 96.
Actually, that's really good news. Can I stop by and put a cooler in your trunk? I gotta drive my parents to graduation and don't want them to see.
Cue the resurrection.
Sure, it's unlocked.
Cooler for what?
I'm Nictionarian 96.
Well, since no one drank at my party, there were 212 beers left over, and we're taking them over to Lacey's for her party tonight.
Cue the resurrection.
212 beers?
I'm Nictionarian 96.
It's a big cooler.
Ben came online then, shouting about how he was already showered and naked and just needed to put on the cap and gown. We were all talking back and forth about our naked graduation. After everyone logged off to get ready, I got in the shower and stood up straight so that the water shot directly at my face, and I started thinking as the water pounded away at me. New York or California? Chicago or D.C.? I could go now, too, I thought. I had a car just as much as she did. I could go to the 5 spots on the map, and even if I didn't find her, it would be more fun than another boiling summer in Orlando. But no. It's like breaking into SeaWorld. It takes an immaculate plan, and then you execute it brilliantly, and then nothing. And then it's just SeaWorld, except darker. She told me, the pleasure isn't in doing the thing, the pleasure is in planning it. And that's what I thought about as I stood beneath the showerhead, the planning. She sits in the mini mall with her notebook, planning. Maybe she's planning a road trip, using the map to imagine routes. She reads the Whitman and highlights, I tramp a perpetual journey, because that's the kind of thing she likes to imagine herself doing, the kind of thing she likes to plan. But is it the kind of thing she likes to actually do? No.
Because Margot knows the secret of leaving, the secret I have only just now learned. Leaving feels good and pure only when you leave something important, something that mattered to you, pulling life out by the roots. But you can't do that until your life has grown roots. And so when she left for good. But I could not believe she had left for a perpetual journey.